Well, good evening. We are in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and we'll be getting down through, say, verses 1 to verse, probably down to about 15 or so. If you notice in verse 16 of chapter 3, verse 16, "And I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there." So right at verse 16, I'm willing to say, and commentators would agree with this, that now he's switching subjects. There may be a connection between verses 1 through 15, but as far as readdressing and completing the discussion of the poem, he now goes off and talks about justice or injustice up through the end of the chapter, and then that leads into chapter 4. So we're actually going to be looking at chapter 3, verses 1 through 15. And if we can say it this way, again, I'm going to sum it up very quickly in a diagram or just a little explanation. And then you can see as we read through this if you think that makes sense. Because this is a poem, and sometimes it wants to be read in a very positive way, that everything is beautiful in its time. And everything's great. But yet I think what we have here is we've got creation and there are things taking place. We're going to list all these emotions, all these events, all these things that are taking place in time, in history. And we're talking about time. Many of them are opposites. You've got war, you've got peace, you've got mourning, you've got dancing, and all these things. And so I don't think this poem is anything about right or wrong, evil or goodness, righteousness or wickedness. It's all just events that are basically appropriate in their time. Our challenge is we live in here, but we're not sure what the right time is. Now, sometimes we've got to make the decision, is it time for war, is it time for peace? And then we've got to make that decision. Sometimes we've got to decide how much rejoicing, how much mourning is right. When do we start rejoicing? When do we stop mourning? These are all things sometimes we control, but ultimately God is in control of them. So the problem comes, if all these things are appropriate, how do we know when it's right or wrong? But then the other thing is, how do they fit together? How can it be right to pick up stones and then throw stones away or scatter them? How can it be right to make peace or make war? Now, we can think of examples, but the world is based on this, but there's going to always come time where we don't know how these two things are working together. They seem to be working apart from each other. And Koheleth is going to say, these things are right, these things are beautiful, they all work together. But the frustrating part is we, once again, don't understand it. We can't see it. God is on the outside, and God sees this. God controls this. God is working all of this together. He's working His plan. And once again, we see things popping up in the New Testament that continue to support this. God is working His plan. But the problem for us that's frustrating for Koheleth is he began at the beginning of the book to go off and figure out how this is connected to this, and this is connected to this. And he's going to explain this. He's called the assembly, and I'm going to explain to you how all of this works together. But the thing, what he realizes, he got to this point, he hit the ceiling. He hit the ceiling. He hit this wall. It's like, I don't know. It seems like chaos in here. And so he gets frustrated because he's going to say, God has set eternity in man's heart, that man realizes, I don't understand this. Man is going to realize there's something greater on the outside, and I don't know this. And so once again, Koheleth is going to have to come back and resign himself to only thing we can't figure this out. And sometimes if you're a teacher or if you're a preacher or if you're a small group leader or you're a self-help seminar presenter, you kind of come across with this impression, okay, I have the magic formula. If you do this, if you live right. Sometimes even sometimes entire ministries are based on the fact that if you will follow the biblical principles, all this will make sense. But this book is saying, again, you got to judge this as I'm teaching this. I think this poem is saying, no, you won't. You can, Koheleth or Solomon himself, I couldn't figure it out. I started a self-help seminar program. And when I started printing out the material, I realized I can't write the final chapter. So it doesn't make sense. Sometimes things just don't work out. But yet God knows this. God controls it, but man himself is frustrated. And the difference is going to be, it's not going to come out clearly in these verses, it'll pop up later, but the difference is man is created with eternity in his heart. He's created with in the image of God. He's created with the desire to understand these things as God has created them. But because of a veil, because of the sin nature, because of how man is created, he knows it works, but he can't figure it out. So it's frustrating for him. And so Solomon is going to basically be saying, animals, now he doesn't use the word animals in this verse. He's going to use them in other places. But an animal, and you may have noticed this, or animals, you look at it, they don't seem to be frustrated. You know, we got squirrels in our yard, or we've got rabbits or deer walking around, and it's kind of like, it's cold out. And they're like, well, we just get warm. We just go, it's like, and they just, they spend, the birds just spend their time flying around looking for food, you know, eating grain or seeds. It's like, don't you have a purpose? And it's like, we're happy. It's like, we live, we eat, we die. It's like, they don't have eternity set in their hearts. But man, and this is, I think, plays into Christians, it plays into false religions, it plays into secularists, it plays into atheists. It's human nature. It's in mankind. If you accept it or if you don't, you're frustrated because you're trying to figure out all of these things. Now, we can find rest in God, and this book leads us to that. But Koheleth is not necessarily leading us to a relationship with God as much as he's leading us into this desperate situation that you're not an animal. You're not satisfied with getting up in the morning, going to work, coming home, going to bed, getting up, going to work, eating a meal. It's just like, you're not an animal. You're created for something more. But the thing is, God's not going to show it to you. He's going to show you certain things, but you are not going to walk away saying, I've got it figured out. And so that's kind of what this chapter is saying. And you see, if you think I'm right, I think this is, well, let's read. I'm going to read through the verses, and then we'll go back and talk through these verses and go through some of the notes. Chapter 3, verse 1. There's time for everything. And a season for every activity under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant, a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to gather them, a time to embrace and a time to refrain, a time to search and a time to give up, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. Verse 9, what does the worker gain from his toil? In other words, doing all these things, what do you gain after all this? I've seen the burden God has laid on men. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Oh, now you see that, we'll talk about this. It seems to be positive. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of man, or men. Yet, the problem is, yet, they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. And this is kind of the summary of that poem. So everything that he said so far, there's a balance here. I can see balance working. Sometimes I create the balance myself in areas of my life. But God has set eternity in man's hearts. Everything is beautiful, but man cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. How this whole thing plays out, you're not going to figure it out. I know that there is nothing better. So now here's some of his points of application from his conclusion, verses 12 through 13 or 15. I know that there is nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken away. God does it so that men will revere him. Whatever has been and what will be has been before. And God will call the past to account. And then verse 16, we begin a new section there. Now, in the ESV, if you look at your notes on page 4, that last verse, Whatever has already been and what will be has been before. The NIV translates it, and God will call the past to account. That's the NIV's way of trying to work it in to help it make sense, which is not a bad idea, but they're pretty clear. There's a letter in the NIV, a footnote that sends you down to the bottom of the page. In other words, another way of translating it is God calls back the past. So in other words, whatever has already been and what will be has been before, and God calls back the past. If you look on page 4 at the bottom there, let's say verse 3:15, the English Standard Version says, that which is already has been, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. In other words, it's talking there apparently about that cycle, meaning what has been is going to be again, and what we're going to do is already have. It's this cycle. And then he mentions God. And what is God doing outside of this? What's God doing? Well, God is calling back what he's already driven away. For example, the things that God has judged and moved on, he seems to bring back into this circle and cause it to happen again. In other words, it's not just we're in this violent cycle of meaninglessness. God seems to be outside here stirring this thing in a circle. And what he moves away, he stirs back up. And what it's like, it's the cycle. Once again, it's a cycle. And the Bible presents cycles of history. The difference between an empty, just atheistic, humanistic view of history, where it's just a cycle of just repeated sunrise, sunset, going nowhere except eternal circles. The Bible presents a spiraling, and that's what I'm going to end with, you know, every time, is this thing. God is calling things back that has been before. He's moving things out, bringing them back, but it's spiraling towards a completion. We do not know when that completion is. We know there is a completion. The Bible has an ending. The Bible has the fulfillment of time. Paul writes about, in the fullness of time, God sent his son. Jesus talks about his return. But we don't know. It's spiraling. We're moving somewhere. Time is progressing. We see that biblically. But yet, even with the Bible's revelation that, hey, there's hope. God knows what's going on. Everyone who trusts in God, your hope is in God. All things are going to work together for your good. Stay with God. And we know that the Bible is going somewhere. It's just not this meaningless drifting throughout time forever and ever and ever. There was in the beginning, God created, and there will be the end. Jesus, I am the Alpha and the Omega. We're going somewhere. So we have confidence through the Word of God, through revelation. But even with this revelation, by believing things that we cannot see, we are still stuck in this cycle of how does this all work together? Again, understand the difference. There are certain things we can measure. Even what I would consider in apologetics, we can prove or explain the existence of God. There's order in the universe. There's our own nature. There's reasons we can apologetically approach the Christian faith and say there's evidence that this is true. But as soon as you present those things, say there's something that is true here, we believe this, people start asking questions. Well, then what about this? What about that? Well, you're going to be making a mistake if you try to step outside the circle and start answering all these questions that even Solomon says, men don't know those answers. God has intentionally, well, it says right here, where it is that, I know there's nothing, okay. Oh, yeah, verse 14. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken from it. God does it so that men will revere him. And we're going to talk about that God has done that. Meaning you're going to get in here and realize there's no university, there's no scholar, there's no scientist, there's no philosopher that can answer every question. In other words, eventually every philosopher should hit this wall, this tunnel, this ceiling, and say, I don't know. There's something outside this. There's order. There's something here, but I can't answer every question. There's something bigger that's beyond mankind. And that's where Solomon gets to. So with that introduction, I've kind of, you know, talked through those verses. Let's go back and walk through this poem. It's a great poem, but I don't think we can separate verses 1 through 8 from verses 9 through 15. 9 through 15 is kind of like a summary of what was Solomon or Kohelet trying to say in those verses. Okay, so here we go. Chapter 3, verse 1. I'm looking at the notes right here. For everything, there's a seat. I'm looking on the notes where this, the notes are in NIV, or in English Standard Version. For everything, there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. And the topic here is the proper time. And even in these verses, one of the signs of wisdom is the ability to know when that time is right. A great one is over in verse 7, a time to be silent and a time to speak. Don't we always wish we knew when that time was? Or, you know, I wish I would have kept my mouth shut, but I was speaking when I shouldn't have. Or I wish I would have said something when I had nothing to say. And that's point B under 3:1, Proverbs 15:23. To make an apt answer is a joy to a man, and a word in season, how good is it? To be that one that has the word to speak at in season. You can say something that's right at the wrong time, and it's not very productive. But that same statement at the right time in the right season, how pleasant it is. How pleasant it is to be able to be that man that knows the right thing to say, but also knows the right time to say it. You've tried it before, those little sarcastic, you know, comebacks that you just don't have anything to say, and then on your way home you think, oh, I wish I would have said that. That would have shut them up, or that would have been a good answer. But you don't think of it until an hour and a half later. It's kind of like that kind of a thing here. Also, you can see a time to search in verse 6. A time to search and a time to give up. I think we referred to that last week. When there is a time to stop searching, you're not going to find it. But when is it? How about if you just would have looked for 10 more minutes or went through one more room, opened up one more drawer, you would have found it, but you quit too early. How do you know when that time is? Well, one of the things, wisdom would be the one that knows when to stop and when to start searching. Going back to the notes, it says in point D, there's no real difference between the words season and time. So when we read this, there's a season and time for everything. Not necessarily trying to find an explanation or a breakdown of those words other than there are synonyms. Time appears 28 times in 7 verses. Event in every matter refers to the human activity that results as a choice made by men. So whenever it talks about every matter, every event, these things that we see take place here, these are in time that man finds himself. These are things that man will engage in and initiate. He's the one that's going to start to mourn or start to dance. He's the one that's going to start to search or give up the search. He's the one that's going to gather stones. And so there's a time and a season, and now man is going to take this event and engage in an event. Is it the right or wrong event? Now, the point that we said before, none of these are right or wrong. It's just a matter of, are they the right time to do this event? For example, to kill and to heal, to tear down, to build up. It's not listing the negatives and the positives, the evil and the righteous. It's listing all these events that men must choose to do or must experience. Now, the matter is this the right one or not? They're all right, but at what time? This says in point G, the student of these verses has decided which is the focus. Kohelet is saying that the extreme of every action and decision of man makes that man can make is appropriate, even necessary at the right time. So not only is it appropriate, but for example, to kill, there is a necessary time to kill. There is a necessary time to heal. There's a necessary time to mourn. There's a necessary time to dance. They're appropriate and even necessary. And you've got to decide like between number A and B. Or as Kohelet is saying, that all these events are in the hands of God. He either causes or judges with the approval of every action at an appropriate time. So in other words, is this a matter of God saying this is the appropriate time? Can you figure it out? And then he's going to judge you if you make the right decision. So there is that matter of human activity in this, of you making the right choice, but also on the outside of God being supreme, knowing this is the right season to gather stones, or this is the right season to go to war or to offer peace. And the wise man is going to be the one who follows that. At H, it says, it is possible that Kohelet is saying that although there is a right time for all these things, the challenge comes in knowing when, and that's what we've mentioned that already. And in some cases, it goes on and says in these notes, it is impossible to know for certain. And that's part of the frustration is Kohelet is saying, okay, it's pretty clear. And you can see this in politics. You see this in your own life and personal decisions, but you can really see it in politics. is, we just throw the Democrats and Republicans out there, for example, is like, is every decision the Republicans make right or is it wrong? Is every decision the Democrats make right or wrong? It's like, well, it's not that easy. It's not, well, everything, you know, this individual does in the government is wrong. It's like, well, that's kind of where we get too polarized. And the problem with that is not everything they do, you have to judge the situation, not just the easy straight party ticket kind of a concept there. And so it is impossible to know for certain when the time to kill is. And so you can understand why sometimes, even in politics, some are saying we should go to war, we shouldn't go to war. And it's like, what are they seeing? Again, we all have our political views. I've got my political views. And I think I know who the enemy is and who the problem is in our government. But at the same time, who knows? Who knows? And who's to say that a particular group or an individual is always wrong? And so it is impossible here to know. That's one of the frustrating things for Koleth is it's impossible to absolutely know how it all comes together. So now we begin the list. Chapter 3, verse 2. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck up what is planted. Some of these things are very obvious, but I do want to mention them because there may be some insights that we can gather from explaining some of them. Between chapter 3, verses 2 through 8, there are 14 opposites. So we are now going to be looking at 14, generally 14 opposites. One is this way, one is this way. And again, you can't categorize these. These are the good options, these are the bad options. The poem begins by saying, these things are both good, they're both necessary. The issue is the time. When is the right time? You should be doing this sometimes, you should be doing this sometimes. But the question is, are you doing it at the right time? And that's, again, frustrating because there's not... How do you know what the right time is if you can't see the whole picture? It's like putting together the puzzle and saying, this piece goes right here, but yet you don't have the pieces that surround it. And so you're never going to know. Because we're surrounded by eternity, and there's things outside of our temporal time that we can't see. So he is saying, these are all appropriate. These are 14 things... 14 opposites that are necessary, but I can't tell you exactly when and where. The contrasting opposites are a figure of speech called merisms in the Hebrew poetry, M-E-R-I-S-M. It's a type of speech. You'll see this even in the prophets. They give you opposites, and it's supposed to connect or represent or give the impression of completeness. So when you say a time to be born, a time to die, boom, there's your complete. And that would then not just the extremes, but everything in between the extremes. A time to search and a time to give up. And everything in between, going into the search and giving up the search, everything in between is complete. So again, although there's 14 opposites, those 14 opposites basically are trying to encompass everything possible, every event a man could possibly engage in somewhere on the spectrum, there's a time for it. Chapter 3, verse 3, a time to kill, a time to heal. Killing can refer to capital punishment or killing in war. It doesn't matter. So, I mean, it depends on, again, I think we can support biblically there's a place for capital punishment. And I think the government is responsible for capital punishment for certain crimes. And killing in war. There's a time to eliminate people that are coming against your government, your society, your culture. Who's right or who's wrong? Everybody's a freedom fighter. It depends on what side of the line you're on. So there's a place for that. But it's just saying kill. It doesn't make it specific. It's just saying a time to kill. It can refer to capital punishment by government. It can refer to killing in war, killing in self-defense. It's not making it specific, but it does include those options. Time to break down and a time to build up or tear down or build. The word build is usually refers to construction as far as building something up. Not necessarily the building up an individual's self-esteem, but actually building a structure. The words are used to refer to a wide variety of activities. Tear down could refer to the results of warfare. This could then mean that after the military conflict, there's a time to build up, and then there's a time to tear down. Whenever a military would go into an area, they would destroy the buildings, or they'd tear down the fields. And then when they had peace and had established control, they'd then begin to rebuild. So there's a time to tear things down, or it could be as simple as time to build a new house. But when your house gets old, there's a time to tear it down. Even though it's been in the family for 200 years, the thing is old, tear it down. It's time to get some new plumbing in. And so it could be something as simple as that. A time to weep and laugh is is pretty clear. And this moves into the areas of emotions. So again, we've talked about events, but now we're talking about the inner side of a man. Not just the things man does externally, but the things man experiences and allows himself to feel. If you never weep, if you never rejoice, that would indicate probably a problem. You're not allowing certain things to take place. A time to mourn and a time to dance. So that comes right in there in the same group. They're weeping and laughing. A connection could be made right here. Weeping and laughing could be private demonstrations of the extremes. You're weeping, you're laughing. It's not necessarily a public demonstration. But this next one, mourning and dancing, could be, again, it's not a slam dunk, but those in the culture that Solomon was familiar with are more of a public display. Again, you can mourn privately, you can dance privately. But usually when you are mourning, it was a public demonstration, the way you took care of your hair or didn't take care of your hair, the clothes you wore, the things you did or didn't do. It was a public expression of I am in mourning. Or when you started dancing, it's more likely that you go to a public place to demonstrate dancing. So the first emotions could be private, weeping and laughing, contrasting with the public demonstration of mourning and dancing. And again, there's not much to say about that. I mean, you could talk about the applications of it. But again, it's the extreme from weeping and laughing and all in between, and mourning where you're publicly not engaging in activities, to dancing where you're publicly out mixing it up with everyone on the dance floor. There's the extremes. There's a place to be in all of that. A time to, chapter 3, verse 5, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. And the meaning of this is debated. What are we talking about here? And it can get very involved in different areas. One obvious suggestion, I don't want to spend too much time on military, because we're going to talk about war and peace. We're going to talk about tearing down and building up. But one of the things we have in the Bible, and we've got the references here, is to destroy the enemy's agriculture, they would bring in stones. And you see there's two references. 2 Kings has got a couple situations there where men were commanded, after they destroyed the enemy, they picked everyone man was to bring a stone and throw it in the field. So if you can imagine an army, after having defeated the enemy, and the victors, every one of them bringing a stone and throwing it in the field, which means now it's going to be very difficult to harvest or plant and harvest in this field. And then gathering stones is necessary to prepare a field. And you see that in Isaiah 5:2 and other places, where to clear a field and prepare it for farming, you'd remove the stones. And so that is just an illustration. So a time to cast stones and time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. The Hebrew word is HBQ for embracing. HBQ. And it refers to an action of affection. In Proverbs 5:20, HBQ, the word, is used referred to sexual intercourse. In Genesis 29:13, 2 Kings 4, the same word is used as a form of greeting. In other words, shaking hands, embracing, meeting someone on the street. And most likely this right here, time to embrace and not embrace, is probably, as you see in the notes, is probably more referring to the ideal of embracing in a greeting and not in sexual intercourse. But, you know, the application's there if you need it. A time to seek and a time to lose. And this, again, I put in here and I refer to it. This is an example of the vanity of time. I mean, how much time are you going to spend wasting looking for something that no longer exists? It's gone. And that can be a variety of things. So when do you decide to keep looking, and when do you decide to just give up the hunt? And that goes to the next one, chapter 3, verse 6, a time to keep and a time to cast away. Now you've got something. How long do you hang on to this? And when is it time to just let it go? It's no longer valuable. And that can be objects. It can be relationships. It can be a part of history. Chapter 3, verse 7, a time to tear and a time to sow. And again, this could be connected to, back up as I put in here, obviously just anything, tearing, a time to tear the clothes and use them for rags, a time to sew and patch up a pair of clothes because they're not shot yet. And it kind of depends on your culture and where you're at. I've seen old pictures of myself and even of my dad when he was younger, back in the days of the Depression, and they had clothes on that were patched extensively. And it's like once you had it, you just kept patching it. Where in our day, at this time in our economy, something gets torn or out of style or a little bit worn, we throw it away. In fact, I get in trouble sometimes for, Galen, throw it away. It's like, well, I like it. Yeah, we can still, no, it looks ridiculous. Now, again, that's more of a cultural thing. Throw it away and get something that looks appropriate. And so, nonetheless, the tearing could refer to mourning. Again, this is just throwing it out there. Because when people would mourn, they would tear their clothes. But there's a time to end the mourning and sew them back together and come back into society. And I end that by saying, but this may just be a coincidental connection that these words make. Meaning we've already talked about mourning and dancing above. It's hard to think that they're referring to that again. But it would fit. A time to keep silent and a time to speak. And, of course, the book of Proverbs is filled with advice on when it's good to say something and when it's good not to say something. You know, like it talks about, if you rise early and greet your neighbor loudly, it'll be considered a curse. Meaning early in the morning is not a good time to go start knocking on everybody's door and say, hey, I hope you have a great day, is shouting across the neighborhood. Early in the morning is a good day to get up, have a cup of coffee, go out on the deck, be quiet, be peaceful, because everybody's just waking up. Your joyful celebration early in the morning is not going to be considered a joyful celebration. It's considered you sending a curse to your neighbor. And so, in other words, that's an example of a time to be silent, time to speak. And the book of Proverbs says many other things about that. A time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. And once again, we put this in here. War, peace, love, hate. Now, notice right here the way I wrote them on the boards is not the way they appear in the text. See, we'd want to draw a line down here in the parallel. War and peace, hate and love. But if you look at it, it's actually, the parallels are love and hate like this. And I think I've got a little diagram there at the bottom of the page. Love, hate, and then peace, war. I got these turned around. But the idea there is they're not even put in parallels. Meaning this is not necessarily equal to peace, and this is not equal to war. They're not trying to parallel those. Meaning this is not, war and hate are not the wrong, and peace and love are not the right. Sometimes peace is right, sometimes love is right, but sometimes war and sometimes hate are the right choices. These are all, again, in the Christian community today and are watered down, everybody's happy. That doesn't even make sense because all these hate, you should never hate anybody. Biblically, there's a place for hate. Biblically, there's a place for war, but biblically, there's a place for love and a place for peace, too. And so that's what Solomon is addressing there, and I think that's important to understand. And the kind of the lack of parallel I put there, point C, Koheleth is not saying war and hate are bad, neither is he saying love and peace are always good or right. Notice they're not written in parallels. I'm on page 3 of the notes now. Chapter 3, verse 9. With the ending of the poem, I'll read the poem one more time in the NIV, and then we're going to start in verse 9, and now we're going to begin in verse 9. What does the worker gain from his toil? That is a follow-up to the poem. He's asking, okay, what's been gained? If all these things we're doing this, we're doing this, we're doing this, sometimes we're doing this, we're tearing down and then we're going to build it up, or we're going to throw stones and then gather the stones back up, we're having war. Okay, this is just a chaotic cycle of sometimes it's appropriate, and so he asks, well, what does the worker gain? I'm going to read it again so you can hear it, but then we're going to hit verse 9, and now he's going to go back, and I think you're going to definitely, if you haven't already, you're going to hear the negative in this of he's coming up. We don't understand what's going on. Chapter 3, verse 1, there's a time for everything, a season for every activity under heaven, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to uproot, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to tear down, and a time to build, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to gather them, a time to embrace and a time to refrain, a time to search and a time to give up, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear, a time to mend, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. Okay, there's the poem. The poem is over. Now, what does the worker gain from his toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on men. He's made everything beautiful in its time. What he's just said, all these things are beautiful in their time, yet he has also said eternity in the hearts of men. So in this cycle, everything is appropriate in its time. If you are a bird, the sun comes up, it's a time to fly out of your nest, go find some food, fly around. When the sun goes down, it's time to go back to your nest, go to sleep, and get do it again. It's like, fine, everything's beautiful in its time. I wish I was a bird. Yeah, I mean, I don't. Yeah, don't. But I mean, the idea, the concept I think is saying here, everything is perfect. Everything is perfect. Just do your job. You're a bird, be a bird. If you're a squirrel, be a squirrel. Just, and you just, they're not upset. They just do their job. But the problem comes, it says, he has also set eternity in the hearts of men. Here's the difference. You have the ability, because you're made in the image of God, to recognize, wait a minute, this isn't making sense. There's more to my life than getting up in the morning, going to work, to make money, to come home, to eat food, to go to sleep, to get up. And then I want to have a family. I definitely want to have a family. Why? So I can put them in the same vicious cycle I'm in, so they can get up and they can all get jobs. And then we get together for Christmas, talk about how miserable our lives are, because we did the same thing the last 20 years. We get together at Christmas and have this family routine. And it's our, guys, listen, all we do is get up, go to work, come back, and a year later we come back here and have Christmas together. It's like, now a bird doesn't get frustrated like that. It's just we just live, eat, breathe, die, and reproduce. It's like, and they're happy. But the problem with man is when they get together at Christmas or whenever they get together, it's like, what's happening? What is the meaning? And again, I'm going to insert this. A lot of times it's easy for us then, in our culture especially, to get distracted by something that, wow, this is important. Whatever the events, the award show on TV, or this going on right here, or whatever, it's like, oh, and you begin chasing after something that's like, oh, I found meaning. Or at least you're, like we said a couple weeks ago, you're in that tunnel. And at least now you're distracted from the fact that eternity is in your heart. But I'm not even really looking at it because I'm so busy doing this carnal activity. Okay, on the notes, chapter 3, verse 9. What gain has the worker from his toil? I write point A, the poem has ended. B, Koheleth summarized with a negative rhetorical question that seems to be saying these things. Now, this, again, is my summary of this, or me trying to explain what I think Koheleth is summarizing. He's written the poem, we've read the poem, and then he ends by saying, what's the point? All this work that everybody's doing, what do they gain? It just falls apart, we got to go back and do it again. Point A under B, I got to learn how to do the from the capital letters and do something different there. But there are many activities, events, and emotions that occur. Okay, that's one fact. All these things are appropriate at some time. C, all these things are designed, approved, and appointed by God. Meaning they're all okay. We're not talking about sin here. We're talking about things, emotions, events, and times that God has designed for mankind. Sometimes the seasons and times God has control over, but we have the choice of what we're going to do, what event we're going to partake in, if it's war, if it's peace, or what emotion we're going to partake in, if it's mourning or if it's dancing. There's not right or wrong. They're all appropriate at their time. Okay, so they're all designed and approved by God. It's all fine. It doesn't mean you can't sin. You can make the wrong choice. You can be dancing at the wrong time, mourning at the wrong time, attacking the wrong enemy at the wrong time. But the point is, all these activities, you've got to decide when it's right and wrong. Yet, all these things are conflicting and ultimately undo each other. I mean, as surely as you have peace and you rebuild the country, someone's going to come by later at the right time and tear it down. They're going to tear down the monuments. They're going to throw stones in your field. It's the right time. Well, it was the right time a few years ago to put the monuments up and clear the fields. Well, now that's gone. It's time to destroy it. So now we're into that vanity cycle. The conclusion, what is gain? A nation rises up, it builds itself up, it builds exports, goods, and builds up an economy, and then all of a sudden, it's all taken apart, and another country rises up, and the other country goes into destruction. Well, what was gain? What was gain in all that? And so the point right here, after saying what is gain, there's nothing gaining here, we're just going in this vicious circle. The point, God has designed these things and appointed times, but we do not know the why. And that goes back to this right here. We do not know everything happening, but we don't know why. How do we fix it? How do we engage? How do we get outside and see the big picture? Sometimes we don't even know the right time or the right response. The ultimate understanding is hidden. Because we are in this tunnel, we're locked in time. God is outside of here. We're doing the best we can, but yet we don't. So chapter 3, verse 10, Solomon writes, I have seen the business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. He says, I've seen this. I've watched this take place over years. I've experienced it. I've examined it. I've philosophized about it. He says, I have seen the business that God has given the children of man to be busy with. And the poem identifies that business. What business? Well, verses 1 through 8. All those things. These are the things that you're busy with. You're mourning. You're dancing. You're tearing down. You're building. You're loving. You're hating. These are all the busy things you're doing. He says, I've seen those things. And you go right here. Compare this to chapter 1, verses 13 through 14. We're not going to do that right now. But again, this is kind of the theme. This lines up with the theme of what Solomon's saying. Chapter 3, verse 11. He says, God, or He, has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, He's put into the hearts, into eternity, in the hearts of man. Yet, so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. So all these things are appropriate. If you're an animal, you're fine. You're just running around doing the appropriate things. But the problem with man, he's put this big hole in his heart, this understanding that there's something out here that man can't figure out. I don't know what it is. And so, and I've explained that, I think, extensively already. And I'm going to go down to point C under chapter 3, verse 11. The point, again, seems to support the idea that Koheleth is frustrated with his inability to appreciate all things in time, since only God knows and understands the details of personal and human history. Now, wouldn't it be a different life experience if, for some reason, we could see the good and the bad that happened in our life, we can see into eternity on how that's impacting God's plan? I mean, why is this happening to me now? Job would be a great example. And there's others, and even our own lives. Job didn't understand. And God didn't come and give Job the answer. Job is in a similar situation. Job is demanding, I want some answers. And God says, I'm going to come and give you some questions. Meaning you don't even understand what's happening out here. Why are you challenging me with what's happening in here? Basically, God says to Job, He says, Job, from your position, can you tell me what's happening right here? Can you explain to me what this means? Job, and when did this and how did this happen? Job says, I don't know. I have no understanding of this. And God says, okay, Job, but I do know what's out here, so I know why this happened here, and I know why this happened here. So the answer to Job was basically, you need to know God because He sees all and controls all these things. And Job, you need to learn to trust God and not worry about, well, I was treated unfair. You don't know that. You don't know if you were treated unfair. Again, that's the book of Job in a nutshell. And Solomon is now, in a sense, not in Job's position, but philosophically is in a similar place of looking at it saying, I don't know. I don't understand these things. I mentioned point D. I mentioned the animal thing I referred to earlier. Chapter 3, verse 12. Solomon or Koheleth writes, I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. That continues in chapter 3, verse 13. Also, that everyone should eat and drink, take pleasure in his toil. This is a gift, God's gift to man. So after saying all this is being said and done, since man doesn't understand what's outside this circle, Solomon reduced it, I'm going to do it very simply, is to live in joy. Number one, the best you can do is to have joy. Number two is to then do good. In other words, in your situation, is somehow go and do what you consider to be good things. That can be for other people, whatever is considered good. This first one can be considered personal. You have joy. Personally, you have joy in your life. Two, you go do good for others. Then read on in verse 13. And he goes on and gives two more things. Adds it. Three, eat and drink. Again, that doesn't mean party like it's 1999. That means don't be afraid to eat and drink. Don't be afraid to partake of the world that you're living or the tunnel you're stuck in. And the last thing is four, pleasure in work or toil. And I'm going to take the word work off of that and use the word that's in the text right there, toil, because working for me, you say work, you tell my grandson, where's dad? Dad's at work. Well, he's clocked in working, and when he comes home, he's not at work. So we're not just talking about that 8 hours at work, we're talking about the human existence. toil, which includes, you know, shoveling the snow, having a dead car battery, having to go to work, having to come home and deal with everything else that's going on. This is human existence. And if you can find pleasure, if you can find pleasure in the fact you get to shovel your driveway, or if you can find pleasure in the fact that you solve the problem of the dead car battery, if you can find pleasure in the toil, eat and drink, do good, and find joy, notice what it says right here at the end of verse 13, this is God's gift to man. You want a gift from God. Now, again, we're not talking about salvation. We're not talking about how do we live eternally. We're talking about man's existence here on earth in this tunnel. When do you know that you have got God's best? It's called a gift from God. Because a man that doesn't come to reconcile these things, and you're still pushing the envelope saying, I'm going to go outside and figure all these things out, and I'm frustrated, I can't find the meaning to life. Well, listen, you're not going to find the meaning to life. You're not going to connect all the dots. Some things are going to seem meaningless. It doesn't mean they are, but you've got to leave them there. I don't understand. So the best thing you can get from God in this tunnel as a human being is joy, the ability to do good to other people, to eat and drink and enjoy that, and the toil that you're doing is to find pleasure in it. I feel successful because I'm getting these things done. Now, I've got some verses written down here on the next page. Top of page 4 there. I repeat myself there in point B. Man's best condition in life is less than Koheleth had hoped. And again, This is not what Koheleth was after. It's like, I was looking to become like godlike. I was looking to become like philosophically the one who calls the assembly. Here, come to my self-help seminar. I've got all of the answers. Come ye, sit down. I have called the assembly. Here is the meaning to life. This is going to change your perspective. I'm going to tell you things that have never been understood. And at the end of his search, it's like, yeah, we need to cancel that seminar because after all my research, if you are joyful, if you're doing good to other people, if you've got something to eat and you like your job and like getting things done, it's like, that's all God's going to give you. I mean, what about all that? We don't know. Just embrace. You, in a sense, you are, again, I don't want to say this in a derogatory sense or a humanistic way, you are an animal with a soul with created in the image of God. And God has not given you at this point in history the ability to understand everything, like, you know, Adam and Eve looking for that knowledge of good and evil. I want to know all these things. It's like, get back in the tunnel. And what I'm going to get, if you're going to please God, the best you can hope for, that you've got joy, that you can do good things for other people, you can eat and drink and find a pleasure in the toil of your toilsome life. And then notice what it says in chapter 13 at the end, a very important line right here, and we've already read it. It says, this is the gift of God, meaning this is a gift God has offered people. God is offering you this today, joy, the ability to do good to others, eat and drink, and enjoy the toil. Well, that's not good enough for me. I want something else. Well, then go ahead. Live in frustration. Live in confusion. But this is the gift for those who please God, those who come to God. And this would include faith in God. This would include accepting man's limitations. Embrace this. This is what God has given you. Well, that's not good enough. Okay. Well, resist it. And you're going to lose your joy. You're going to refuse to do good because you're getting ripped off. You didn't get your fair share. You're going to abuse eating and drinking until it destroys you. And you're not going to find pleasure. You're going to be burdened by the toil. I got another dead battery in my car. I got more snow. Life is just miserable. It's like, okay. Or you got the other guy that lives right next door who's embraced this, and he's got a gift from God. They're both in the same neighborhood. They're both in the same location. But what right here? The one man realizes the best I can hope for in this life is this right here. Now, that's not denying the fact that you can have salvation through Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ brings meaning to this. And when Jesus says, I have come that you might have life and have it abundantly, I've got to think it means this right here. It doesn't mean you get a bigger house, more sidewalk to shovel, a bigger economy. It means you've got joy where the guy next door to you who's rejected God doesn't have joy. You can do good to people because you've been done good to by God. You're willing to go off and know that you've got something more to give society. You can eat and drink, as we got these verses right here. Look in Timothy. I've got the verses written down there. Point D at the top of page 4. 1 Timothy 6, 8. I think these are all right out of 1 Timothy. And it's amazing how I feel. It's not amazing how I feel. It's amazing how they can connect to this concept right here. Because Timothy, Paul is talking to Timothy and urging him the very same concept right here. See if you think there's a connection here, or at least that the theology is similar. 1 Timothy 6:8. If we have food and clothing, we'll be content with that. 1 Timothy 6:6. Godliness with contentment is great gain. And this is what this is. This is godliness with contentment. I am doing good. I'm trying to imitate my Creator. And I'm content with my life, with my toil, with what I'm eating and drinking. This is gain. Jesus says, I've come that you might have life and have it more abundantly. That is possibly the gain he's talking about. Not that you've got more stuff, but that where you're at, you're experiencing that life of God. It's great gain to be able to have this and embrace it. And then 1 Timothy 4:3, if you get into false religions or doctrines of demons, that's Timothy 4:3, it says right here, they forbid people to marry and order them to abstain from certain foods. In other words, if you reject God and His revelation, you're going to start messing around with this stuff in here, saying you shouldn't do this and you can't do this and you shouldn't be married and you shouldn't drink this or eat that. And they start messing with this. This is doctrines of demons who've rejected the goodness of God. And Paul says they forbid people to marry and order them to abstain from certain foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and who know the truth. What is the truth? Well, Solomon is telling you the truth right here. You don't know these things. And false religions are going to lead you out of this circle and try to tell you, we know all this stuff. No, you don't. You're making this up. You're writing books. You're telling false doctrines, false truths, and it's coming from demons. And it's getting people inside the circle frustrated because it's not real. And they're frustrated with the good gift God has given them. And Paul says right here, they order them to abstain from certain foods, which God, and would marriage, certain foods, which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and who know the truth. For everything God created, including all those things in time, all those things we read in chapter 3, verses 1 through 9, everything God created is good, and nothing is to be rejected. Now, you can talk about food there, but also, nothing is to be rejected. There's a place and time for everything under heaven. And nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving because it is consecrated by the Word of God and prayer. Paul could almost be summarizing Ecclesiastes for Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and also in chapter 6. Meaning this is where we're at. Now this is not denying, I mean, we do have within here the concept of in the New Testament, Jesus came and He commissioned us as believers to take the good news to everyone. So, I mean, you've still got your spiritual gifts, you've still got purpose, but even with that, and I can attest to that, sometimes I get, and I throughout my life, I've dealt with this frustration of, I want to do something substantial. I want to do something important. I don't want to just eat, live my life, and have my job. And you think ministry is going to possibly be a way of making an impression. And you want something bigger, faster, better. And it's like, and you get frustrated and you get pulled into all kinds of false doctrines, false teachings, false measurements of success in ministry. And you don't have this. You don't have joy. You're not really doing anything good for people. You're not even concerned about them. You're not enjoying what you've got. You've got so many religious rules binding you from these things. And you're trying to get away from toil because you've got something more important to do. You don't believe how many times I've felt I've got something more important to do than change a dead car battery. I want to change the world. And God says, I want you to change your car battery. Ah, man, I'm mad, you know, saying things I shouldn't be saying because I don't want this toil. But there's also been times where I've just, and Tony knows all of this, yeah, I just take a breath, say, hey, God is in control. I'm trying to serve God, and now all I got is more snow and a dead car battery. I don't have a dead car battery. You've got a new car. I mean, I'm just using it as an example. And I find myself just taking a breath saying, okay, hey, if this is what God wants me to do, I will try to do my ministry when it occurs, when it's available. But if not, I'm going to shovel snow, change car batteries, and remodel the house. It's like, and then all of a sudden, it's not a burden. It's like, oh, I had a good day. I got this done, got that done. It's like, did you do any advancing of the ministry? It's like, no, I didn't have the chance. I was trying, but I had too many other things that I got stuck doing. And I can be upset about it, but I need to be upset with the toil I have, or I can find pleasure in it. And I think we've all done that, found pleasure in preparing something, or we're burdened in the fact that we had to prepare something. And this, too, is a gift of God. So I think false doctrine will get you out here looking at things that are not important, not even your business, where if you will just do what God's called you to do, Old Testament, New Testament, this right here, to enjoy life, is a gift from God. And Paul, I mean, look, you say, well, that's not the way Paul was. Paul was too. If we have food and clothing, we'll be content. Godliness with contentment is great gain. And the false doctrines forbid people from certain foods and even from marriage. But God created all these things to be enjoyed. Enjoy it. And that's what Solomon's saying. Now, is Solomon happy with this answer? You understand? Well, let's finish reading verse 15 here. Or 14. So it appears that Solomon, the way I present it, Solomon's come to conclusion, okay, well, this is great. Then I'll just kind of kick back and do this right here. He's not happy with the answer. He was wanting to see this stuff here. He wanted to get outside the circle and dabble in the stuff that man is not permitted to know. He wanted to go where false doctrines and false philosophies go. I want to find these things out. Now, I'll throw this in there. This may explain why Solomon ends up building temples to the pagan gods, and Solomon ends up in false worship, and Solomon ends up being a wicked king so bad that his kingdom was torn from him. Half the king, not half, but what would it be, 10/12 of the kingdom was torn from him and given to someone else because he didn't stop here. Maybe Solomon wrote the answer, but he doesn't like the answer, and so he continued to do this, and the many foreign women that he married, he's still looking for answers potentially. Again, we know Solomon doesn't end well, yet we know Solomon's dealing with the answers here. Did he not settle here, but continue to go out here, where Paul says the doctrines of demons will lead you, and they'll forbid certain things that God intends for you to be enjoying in this circle? You're a man. Enjoy these things. But you have eternity in your heart. You want something bigger. You want to be godlike. But you can't go there. Stay in your circle. Again, I don't want to say it in a negative way. It sounds so terrible. But you're part animal. You're made out of the dirt, just like an animal. But yet God breathed His life into you and put His image in you. You're made in God's image. So you've got to live on this planet. You've got to enjoy this planet and where you're at. But deal with that burden of having a hunger for something beyond. God's answered it with the bread of life. Accept what it is, but realize you can't go outside this. This is God's business. He's given you a gift to enjoy here, and don't go outside this. Well, here we go. Solomon says, beginning in verse 12, I know that there is nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever, meaning everything God is planning, it's going to go on forever. Not necessarily the cycles, but what He's doing is going to last forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken away. God does it so men will revere Him. To get to this place to realize, okay, there's things out here that I don't know, like Job. And Job says, okay, I cover my mouth. I'll just listen to you. Because God showed him, you fear God, not afraid of Him, but you honor Him. It's like, no one can go here. My only access to here outside the circle is God. So we fear God, we trust God, we seek after God. And then verse 15, he sums it up, whatever has already been, and what will be has been before. And then at the footnote there in the NIV, God calls back the past, or like you saw in the ESV, it says, that which is already has been, that which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. In this cycle of life that we're going through, all these things come and go, but it's God outside who keeps the cycle going. Something may be moved away. Well, we'll never see that again. We got rid of that in human history. Yeah, well, guess what? God's going to bring it back into the cycle. I mean, you just see nations come and go. Well, you know, I mean, Europe's a classic example. They've got human rights. Everything is organized. They're going to go more liberal and all. And pretty soon, here comes and brings it back up. It's like, well, what is this? This is called barbarianism. It's like, I thought we got rid of barbarianism when Christianity conquered Europe. Uh-huh. But guess what? They've abandoned Christianity, and here comes barbarianism back. Where'd that come from? God. It's like, well, England was the leader in Christianity. Europe was the leader in Christianity. The Reformation led the world in Christianity. Yeah, well, they abandoned Christianity, and God stirred back up barbarianism. There you go. You're going back to barbarianism. It's not like Europe's some magical place that isn't barbaric. It's like, because while the Jews and the Greeks and the Romans were civilized, we'll call them, Europe was full of barbarians, we'll call them. They accepted Christianity. They got organized. They led the world in great reformation into the 20th century. And now they're being overrun. So what was has gone away and got stirred up. What was gone? Who's doing this? God? Why? How do we? Well, we got some ideas. But where is this going? Are we in the end times? I don't know. Maybe. Maybe not. I mean, he might be just stirring it up and maybe moving on. We're in a cycle. If we're in this spiral to God's fulfillment, we're going to spiral by end times every time around the circle, if you understand what I'm saying. I mean, it's going to be, oh, here's the end times. No, we're going to ride on by it, but we're going higher. And you go right by it again. And eventually it's going to come out, but we might be cycling right by what I think. This is the end times. No, it's not. And we go, here it is. No, it's not. We're just spiraling. And so that's what he's saying right there. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. But who drove it away? God apparently drove it away himself, because he's the one that's controlling this. He drove it away. It's like, okay, now come on back, and we're going to do it again. And so the point there is, again, frustration. Unless he gave you the answer. Stop trying to figure this out. Go to work. Enjoy your place and time. And if you can, that is the only gift God is going to give you. He's not going to give you the gift of wisdom where you can answer all the divine questions. He's going to give you the gift of joy, of food and drink, of being able to do good to others, and be able to enjoy and find pleasure in the toil that you're locked in. That's the only gift God's going to give you. And that's, I mean, I've accepted that. But there's a time in my life where I would have slammed my Bible shut and says, that's not what I became a Christian. I want something better. It's like, well, there's not. You can read your Bible, you can study and understand certain things that God revealed, but there's a limit. There are certain things you're not going to understand. So with that being said, I'll pray and leave you to your own frustrating lives, unless you want to embrace the gift God has given you, which is to enjoy it. Go shovel snow and hope your car battery's not dead. And if it is, praise God. I don't know. You don't have to accept that, but I mean, it seems to be fitting because Solomon's toying with those answers. I'll pray so you guys can go home. Father, we thank you so much for your truth. We ask that I would handle it correctly. We ask that if I've misspoken, that you would correct it, that you would bring teachers and verses and remembrance of other teachings to people's minds so that, again, they may find the truth, because that is what we desire, is to walk into wisdom, that we may find peace in Christ, that we may find fulfillment in Christ and do the things he's called us to do. Father, we do thank you for the joy you've set before us. We thank you for the provisions you provided for us, and ask that we again would embrace them and honor you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you very much for being here.